Welcome to Let's Talk Legal, part of Coastal Daybreak every Tuesday morning and brought to you by Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. You can call in now to have your legal questions answered by attorneys Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Call in now with your questions at 252-247-7282.
And Cecil Harvell is in the studio with us. Good morning, Cecil. How are you?
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Doing well. What are we talking about today?
Ben, I thought we'd touch on a couple of New Year's, if you will, things that we would want to reiterate here right at the first of the year. There's been a couple of changes. Of course, there always are changes in the law, but one of the changes that is effective January 1 is the fact that the spousal allowance, or sometimes referred to as the year's allowance,
right,
in an estate,
mm-hmm,
has increased from $30,000 to $60,000.
Right, okay.
We begin to see in the law over and over again, and the other issue we're going to discuss here in a few minutes is, you know, the effect of inflation,
yeah,
I guess, on the law. But the year's allowance is a very, very useful allowance for the surviving spouse. Basically, it states that notwithstanding the presence of creditors,
mm-hmm,
and other issues that might be lurking in the estate of the death of a wife or husband or what, or spouse, whatever the case might be, that the surviving spouse has an absolute right to the first $60,000 of personal property.
And that's up from what?
30.
It was 30. Okay.
It was 30.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, and often it's crucial. It's crucial for their survival. Right?
Well, it is really applicable, we find, in the case of, you know, where, you know, a husband dies with a lot of credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other way around, you,
mm-hmm,
know, the wife,
right,
dies with credit card debt. And the surviving spouse's name is not on that debt.
Right.
It was the exclusive credit card of the husband.
Right.
And the wife's question to us is that, you know, they assume that they have to pay that debt.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't,
mm-hmm,
necessarily. Particularly if all the facts come together and we can file for the year's support,
mm-hmm,
year's allowance, then the bottom line is that it's very likely that that creditor might not get paid. Now, again, we have to look at all the facts and circumstances.
Sure.
But I would say that the application of that in our office, the application of this law in our office, is been more related to that issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Related to the issue of whether or not a surviving spouse is going to be personally liable, if,
mm-hmm,
you will, for the debt of the debts of their deceased spouse. We see a lot of files where we're able to get a very favorable result for the surviving spouse given the opportunity to make this filing.
Yeah, and that filing isn't automatic, right? I mean,
you have to make the filing,
mm-hmm,
okay, during the time period,
right,
that you have the estate under administration. See, many folks own their home, if you will, is joint tenants by entirety,
correct,
husband,
yeah,
and wife, and as a result of that, that asset is not subject to the collection of debt because it's a joint asset owned between husband and wife in that special tenancy that we've discussed before here on the program, tenants by entirety.
Mm-hmm.
So creditors aren't going to be able to attach that. They also, under most circumstances, are not able to attach non-probate assets like, for instance, the beneficiary of a life insurance policy,
mm-hmm,
the beneficiary of a retirement plan, the beneficiary of an IRA. All of these things would pass to the wife or the husband by beneficiary. And so we're left with the assets that are in the estate, and sometimes there are not a lot of assets of the decedent that are actually probate assets, particularly after you make this election for the year's allowance.
Right,
that's
right.
That's the point.
They may drain it,
right,
really.
Correct.
Right.
And so it has doubled, which, mm-hmm, is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Now, another thing let's talk about this morning, and I'm going to veer over to litigation, which is dangerous, as we all know, usually Wes handles,
yeah, that's
that for,
right,
us. But
A belated happy birthday to Les, too, by
yes,
the way. It's his
happy
birthday.
Yesterday. Absolutely. But look, one of the things that we need to remind our listeners about is that, you know, litigation in North Carolina District Court, Superior Court, it is a long and drawn-out process.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it can cost, you know, really, truly, we hate to say it, but tens of thousands of dollars just due to the complexity of litigation in those courts.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to remember and remind our listeners, which I want to do right now, that, you know, the small claims or magistrate court in North Carolina, the jurisdictional limit now is up to $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's right much, Ben.
Yeah. It was five for a long time.
I think it was 2,000 when I took the bar exam back a while ago, obviously. And it has consistently gone up.
Small claims have gotten bigger.
Small claims have gotten bigger, and inflation has made itself known in this area of the law. You know, most parties in a small claims court, you know, they're self-represented, mm-hmm. which sometimes we call the fancy word for that is pro se.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily have to have a lawyer. You can have a lawyer, but you don't have to. You're able to file the forms generally at the clerk's office in the magistrate court. Okay, the filing fees are less to file a magistrate court $10,000 or less claim than the filing fees in the district court or the superior court. And these cases, you know, move very quickly. Usually they would be tried within 30 days. Well, my goodness, that is a much, much quicker process than the district or superior court, which, you know, may take as much as just, you know, 9 months to a year or a little bit more before you even are heard.
Or even get on a docket,
due to the backlog, correct. Okay. There are no jury trials in the small claims court. And so there's not going to be a jury trial, which there could be in district or superior court. The magistrate or the judge of the magistrate court is going to make the decision and may make an order. Also in the magistrate court, which is a little bit different, is that the magistrate can order that the successful party be awarded court cost, although that's up to the discretion of the magistrate. Again, that's something the magistrate can do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's important, very important to know that the magistrate court orders are, you know, can be appealed within 10 days. And then there's what, again, a fancy word, de novo, or all new.
Starts over.
At the district court or superior court level, wherever the jurisdictional limit would apply. And so what does this mean? Well, what this means for our listeners to understand is that if you have a small claim, a claim of $10,000 or less, then you're going to have an opportunity to kind of flesh out the facts and find out exactly what your adverse party is saying. What documents do they have? Is there some sort of writing or indicia of the agreement or whatever the conflict might be? And you're able to get the facts out there, and then you have the benefit of being able to appeal the decision if you don't like it, but now, of course, or don't agree with it, but now, of course, you have some additional facts. You know what what your adverse party is saying.
Right.
Sometimes in conflicts, folks really are, if you will, at an impasse. They're in a conflict, and there's no conversation. And as a result of there being no conversation, there's really, a misunderstanding. So the small claims court is an extraordinarily valuable place in our society now, this day and time. And in 2019, we wanted our listeners to know that this jurisdictional limit is higher than it used to be. It hasn't gone up this year. It was $10,000 last year as well. But it certainly is up considerably from where it used to be.
Now, when you do make an appeal here, is it typical for a judge to suggest mitigation or some sort of mediation or some other kind of discussion?
Once it's appealed to district or superior court, those rules of those courts are mandatory, mandatory mediation.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be mediation of some degree now in cases that are filed in those courts. And so, yes, there will be an opportunity for there to be mediation.
So even if it does go to trial, you would end up narrowing the facts down.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's right. One of the things that we've talked about before on the program, Ben, is the word discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm off in the litigation arena this morning, which is interesting. But the bottom line is discovery is, you know, depositions, statements of witnesses, requests for production of documents to get the documents in front of the lawyers and judges, requests to admit certain facts or requests for admissions, interrogatories, which are sworn answers, if you will, to questions that the lawyers might want to propose to either party, and ask specific questions and then have a specific answer that is sworn to, like testimony. Okay, these things, of course, are all within the category, the large category of discovery. And of course, mediation helps greatly also, because again, you know, I like to use the word kind of flesh out the facts, kind of get to a point here in knowing exactly what the issues are going to be more specifically when you get to trial. So discovery is a very useful thing. Mediation is. We don't have those processes, if you will, in the small claims court.
Right.
But you would have them later on in the higher courts. But the small claims court is a good place to start, absolutely, if your claim is $10,000 or less.
All right, we'll have more to come in a moment with Cecil Harvell from Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. If you'd like to call in with your question, 247-7282. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell from Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. What else are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're kind of generally talking about kind of a hodgepodge of issues here this morning, Ben, concerning our new year and things to for our listeners to consider. One thing, of course, just to I know I'm reviewing, but I just want to, is for our listeners to really understand that in the estate arena, with this year's support increase from $30,000 to $60,000, you know, our clients and our listeners out there really do need to consult with a lawyer if you have a death in your family, and see how all of the facts might line up.
Right.
We get questions every day, Ben. I want another great thing to say at the beginning of the year. You know, an initial appointment at our office, and also at most law offices, I might add. I don't really know of any that are not this way. Your initial consultation is complimentary. And that's kind of a quid pro quo between the lawyer and the potential client, because, you know, the lawyer doesn't really know what the case is about and what the details are and what the facts might be.
Or even if there is a case,
or even if there is the need for the lawyer to intervene in the estate. I mean, I see clients often in the estate arena, let's say, and they're just fine handling the estate on their own without the use of a lawyer. That's becoming less and less frequent, but it does happen. I saw a lady last week who was in urgent need of an updated estate plan, and lo and behold, the only thing that she really needed updating was her will and a trust. Her power of attorney, her health care, her living will, they'd all been done within the last year or so, and they were just fine. So the lawyer wants the opportunity to meet with the client, to review the documents, to review the facts and circumstances, and then advise about what, if anything, needs to be done. And this would be true in the estate arena as well. And then after we have a better understanding of the facts, we're able to give the client, a fee, okay, and
right.
to tell more precisely what some of these things might cost. You're just not able to do that over the telephone or in an email inquiry because you really are in the dark. So it's a quid pro quo on both sides. The lawyer needs to understand the facts. The client needs to understand exactly what the objectives of the lawyer might be. And after that meeting of the minds, then, of course, the lawyer-client relationship is established and a file is opened, and off we go. So keep that in mind, all of you wonderful listeners this morning. Seek legal advice.
Mm-hmm.
It probably isn't going to cost anything for the first 30 minutes to an hour
right.
while the lawyer attempts to understand what your circumstances are and what the issues might be with you or your family or your wife or your husband or your child, whatever the case might be. And just it's so important, though, to ask the questions initially.
And to get there before you've done things on your own where you might have to undo them.
Correct. In the context of estate, we talk so much about that here on the program, but, Ben, nothing has changed. There was no update, if you will, in the law mm-hmm. relative to the need to have your affairs in order. We still are going to strongly suggest that everyone have a well-drafted power of attorney, that they look at their wills every 5 to 7 years and see if there needs to be any update, have a consult with your lawyer, and check on things like that. In the area of probate and estate settlement, we continue to see, Ben, and I know that you know this and a lot of our listeners know it, we in the state of North Carolina, I don't like having to say this, but probate is becoming more burdensome than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
There are more requirements now being imposed upon our good clerks of court mm-hmm. and their assistants, of course, not just Carteret, Craven, Onslow, New Hanover,
yeah.
all of the counties are now more burdened with the need for more extensive documentation.
Mm-hmm.
A case in point is that accounts which are joint with right of survivorship, which so many banking accounts are
right.
joint with right of survivorship, the clerk is now required to see the underlying document, if you will, the signature card
mm-hmm.
or the contract at the bank where the account is in fact verifiable
mm-hmm.
joint with right of survivorship. It used to be that, everything that is filed with the clerk of court by an executor is filed under oath.
Right, right.
And is filed under notary. And so the authenticity of the statements, the affirmations that an executor makes have always been required to be truthful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not enough anymore. Right. We're not just going to let you tell us that mm-hmm. it's joint with right of survivorship.
They're not self-proving, I think it's what you'd call
it. Right. We're going to require that we see the underlying substantiation of
mm-hmm.
that. And this, of course, is burdensome. This is, sometimes the banks don't have that information readily available. They have to try to research it and find it.
They've changed hands.
They yeah. don't want to speak with anybody at all, as you know, other
mm-hmm.
than the executor. They want mm-hmm. to see documentation. And so I would say that the probate, and there are other many
mm-hmm.
examples of this, but the probate process in North Carolina is a bit more burdensome than it used to be. And so as a result of that, I would encourage listeners who have a death in their family or have a friend who has a death and seeks their advice
mm-hmm.
that they have a consultation with the lawyer. Again, the lawyer is going to look at the will, if you will, or if there is no will, look at the facts and circumstances concerning the administration without a will
mm-hmm.
and advise the client then whether or not they think their services are needed.
Right. Right.
I mean, I think this is something that I want our listeners to understand. you know, most lawyers are plenty busy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we don't need to help a client or we just need to guide them in some way, then that's what most great and good lawyers are going to do. We need to be involved in substantive issues that really make a difference for a client.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with more on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, in our final break together. If you'd like to sneak in a question, you still can at 247-7282. Hey, welcome back here at Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, and Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law. You can always go online at harvellandcollins.com, listen to the past shows, and find out more about them as well. Cecil Harvell is with us here today as we're kind of wrapping up about some basic foundational things for you to know about.
Yep, we are, and we're talking about these things in light of the fact that here we are in the beginning of a new year and within the first two or three weeks of the first of another new year.
Mm-hmm.
I would say in conclusion here, Ben, as we conclude this morning, you know, all areas of our life touch and concern touch and concern legalities.
Right.
You know, it's important that if you're buying a property, a real property, a land, a house, a lot, whatever the case might be, mm-hmm. that, you know, you seek good legal advice on that. Real estate law is a bit more cumbersome than ever, as well as probate law, as we spoke about a minute or two ago. Contracts need to be in writing, even if they're very simple. I mean, better to have something in writing, even if you and your neighbor mm-hmm. sit down at the kitchen table and hammer out a few sentences.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to go see a lawyer, but let's put our agreements in writing as much as possible so that there's some indicia or evidence of what the agreement happens to be. So what am I saying? In our contract life, in our real estate life, in our wills and trust life, in our, quote, and unfortunately, in our litigation and conflict issues that arise in our life, all of these things, this day and age, as we would anticipate, probably are going to require the use of a lawyer. And don't be afraid of contacting a lawyer. Don't be afraid of asking questions like, how much is this going to cost?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The lawyer should be able to give you a yeah. range of what things cost based on
right.
their experience.
Right.
You know, I've been doing this 30 years. Wes mm-hmm. has been practicing now over 20. I mean, you know, we kind of know mm-hmm. what things cost
yes.
generally at this point. And so I encourage our listeners to be direct mm-hmm. with your lawyer. Ask good questions. Ask anything that worries you or concerns you. Keep the communication just as open as possible. And I think then that you as a listener out there and as a potential client will have a favorable result if you do that.
Yeah. And these are the things, again, like you said, you can come get that consultation and find out exactly where you need to go.
I think that's true across the board. Lawyers are there to give that initial consultation. Again, it works both ways. The lawyer doesn't know really what to say until the lawyer understands the facts a little bit more.
Find out more by calling on the folks at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law at harvellandcollins.com and on Bridges Street in Moorhead City.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up on the comedy show, Matt Falk.
Shopping. You don't say shopping. It's not what you tell us. What do you tell us? Just looking. You still empty the trunk before you go looking.
The Darren Scablo Comedy Show.